What is art and why exactly does it mean so much to us is a question that's puzzled biologists, anthropologists, philosophers, and artists for years. Alvin Noe, a professor of philosophy at the University of California, Berkeley, suggests that art is a tool that we as a species use to stop and catch a glimpse of our everyday activities, a tool that reveals the very nature of what it means to be human. His book, Strange Tools, Art and Human Nature, is published by Hill and Wang. I'm very pleased it has brought him back to our show today. Hello.
It's great to be back.
Before we talk about art, we should talk about perception. What's the difference between what you call seeing in the wild and seeing in pictures?
That's a great question. So much of our lives, we are engaged in this task or that, whether it's tying our shoes or finding the elevator or washing the dishes or going shopping. And when we do all that, assuming that we're normally sighted, we rely on vision. Very little of that involves looking, contemplating, meditating on that which we see. But it simply involves, in a kind of embedded, active way, relying on sight. There's this other thing, though, which we sometimes do, which is contemplate something. Step back, take a look at it, think about its properties. And the best example of that, the most ready-to-hand example of that, are works of art, which invite us to contemplate them and inspect them and think about what we're seeing and think about the seeing itself.
Can we know whether we as a species have always seen in pictures? Might we have seen in pictures before we even had language?
It's interesting, the phrase seeing in pictures. In a way, one of the reasons I emphasize the idea of seeing in the wild and contrasting that with pictorial seeing is that it's not really very natural to characterize seeing in the wild as if the content of our experience is pictorial. But we do have this metaphor of sort of seeing a scene, and we think of, sometimes we look at something and think that how picturesque. We do use the notion of the picture to reflect on our own seeing. And it seems to me that that's something we probably couldn't have done without actually having pictures. And then it becomes very interesting that we've had pictures for 30,000 years. You know,
and most people carry cameras in their pockets these days. Is that evidence that we're seeing the world as a frame for a picture even more now?
I do think so. It's very interesting. There was a book written in the 70s by the great art historian Ann Hollander, who noticed that when people go out of the house in the morning, they look at themselves in the mirror and sort of make a little provisional portrait of themselves in the mirror. And she said, it's almost as if the standard by which we assess the direct awareness of ourselves in the mirror is the picture. The picture gives the standard by which we see ourselves. And that's ever more true today in the era of the selfie.
In the past, pictures were made by certain people mm-hmm. who made pictures, artists and the like. Now anybody can make a picture. So how much is technology responsible for the way we see the world today?
Well, I think it's important to realize that picture making is and has always been a technology. What is a picture really? It's an instrument for showing something, for putting something on display. And the graphical means of doing that have been cultivated by human beings, as I said, for at least 30,000 years, because we know about the ancient cave paintings. It's very interesting that that 30,000 year period ago is about the time there was a huge technological revolution in our ancestors' lives. No longer were we simply using blunt tools. We were now making tools to make tools and specialized parts of tools. So the advent of pictures, like the advent of language, seems to be bound up to technology. It's also important to mention one last thing, that not every picture is a work of art, and not every art is a picture. So art and picture has come apart in an interesting way.
Although when you look at the cave paintings, at least I'm always stunned by how brilliant they are. In fact, I suspect because people were seeing the world fresh through this new technology or whatever we want to call that process, that they actually were doing a better job. I mean, it's hard to capture the freshness of just that line of the cave painters today.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you, but I'm also struck, as my friend, the art historian Alexander Nagel, once mentioned, that when you look at those paintings, it's a little bit like looking at an entire art history, because those caves were made over great periods of time, and presumably they were responding to the way other painters had painted, and it's probably not quite as fresh as it looks. There's a lot of, I would think, of course, this is pure speculation, but I would think that there's a lot of background culture that is hidden by those pictures that we don't know about.
modern pictures can be seen as a form of communication, but you have some interesting examples of human communication in this book that have nothing to do with pictures. You write that breastfeeding is an early form of communication, and you argue that humans are quite bad at breastfeeding compared to other mammals.
Well, it turns out that that's the case. Anthropologists and developmental psychologists have noticed that whereas other mammals will suckle at the breast until they're full, not so the human baby. The human baby gets distracted, falls asleep, hears a noise, and as a result, the mother or the whoever it is that's doing the feeding needs to be engaged in a kind of exchange with the child. And some people have suggested so bad are we at feeding at the breast that maybe we don't feed that way to eat, but maybe we feed that way in order to develop precisely a communicative attachment or relationship.
How does this relate to your subtitle, Art and Human Nature?
Well, one of the interesting things about an activity like breastfeeding is that it's a kind of organization. It's a sort of a behavioral dynamic social structure in which we, as very young children and as young parents, find ourselves. And one of the ideas I offer in the book is that art makes art out of organization, out of the habits, the automaticities, be they of movement or of seeing or of thinking, that characterize our lives. Art comes along and makes art out of that. That's the raw materials of art. So in the case of pictures, we have these ancient picture-using practices. We make pictures to sell. You know, you go online to check out the jacket that you might buy in the online catalog. That's one kind of function picture has. When an artist makes art out of pictures, the artist is I think taking the way in which picture using activities organize us is taken for granted by us, and thus is really doing something remarkable, namely revealing us to ourselves.
But at different times throughout history, the aesthetics have been different. There were, in many cultures, there's no attempt at realism, and then in the Western civilization, we inherited the Greek idea that you wanted to make art that looked like humans, at least marble becomes skin. Then after the fall of the Roman Empire, we moved to a situation where artists are purposely being abstract. And then with the Renaissance, back to some kind of formalized realism. And then at the end of the 19th century into the 20th century, we move into abstraction. And yet people respond emotionally to all those different things.
They engage with art in all sorts of different ways: emotional, intellectual, perceptual, phenomenological. Art can make us think about religion or God or love, or it can make us think about our own visual experience. And I think it's actually always done those things. Sometimes, and one of the interesting things about art is it usually serves multiple functions. So Leonardo had to satisfy a patron, and he also was experimenting with painting as such. Similarly, a lot of religious art of the Middle Ages presumably was meant to serve, among other things, a kind of liturgical or didactic function in the church. I suspect that the art which really remains very important to us as time has gone on is art whose work isn't confined to just to that.
Well, the rationale given to the iconoclast for continuing to paint human figures despite the commandment that says we shouldn't duplicate the image of God was that it was a teaching tool. But at a certain point, it stops being a teaching tool, and people are just looking at things for their aesthetic value. But even when you have this teaching tool, we look at two different pictures, let's say, of Madonna and Child. And one, we say, is a great work, and the other one is just some kind of boring thing, and yet they're telling us the same story.
Right, which is the proof that it goes beyond that function. So I try to differentiate between tools, which are usually designed with some pre-given function, and what I call art, to coin a phrase, that always calls function into question. So works of religious art are very frequently in subtle ways asking you to reflect, usually in novel or sometimes even subversive ways, about their religious subject matter.
You write about a protest that you witnessed outside of NYU in the 1970s in response to a lecture by the biologist E.O. Wilson. What was he saying, and why were people protesting?
That's an anecdote I relate in the book that really comes from my boyhood. I was a very young kid at the time, and I didn't know anything about E.O. Wilson or what he was saying at the time. I just knew that according to the angry protesters and the signs, he was propounding racist ideology. What I later learned as I grew up was that what he was doing was expressing what came to be called, or actually he himself called, sociobiology, what today is sometimes called evolutionary psychology. I think in the 1970s, so soon after the racial crimes of the Second World War and the enlivening of issues about race in this country.
And eugenics,
the whole thing, which was not confined to Europe, but was happening all over the world, including here, I think there was people just couldn't take that kind of approach.
He was writing about ants and how we have certain things in common with ants when we socialize.
Yeah, in his book Sociobiology, which I think came out sometime in the early 70s, he was suggesting that some of the kinds of principles that we see at work in animal populations could also be applied to think about human culture and
so the protesters were upset issues. He was saying we were like ants,
I think what was really controversial was the idea that you might reduce culture to biology, and human cultural values to biological ones.
My guest is Alvin Noe, professor of philosophy at the University of California, Berkeley, where he also serves as a member of the Institute for Cognitive and Brain Sciences. His latest book, Strange Tools, Art and Human Nature, which is the title that you would...
Strange Tools.
Because they're both of equal size, typographically.
That was an innovation of the designer. But the book is called Strange Tools, and its subject matter is given by the subtitle, Art and Human Nature. I mean, the thing, if I could just go back for a second to the question you asked about E.O. Wilson, one of the reasons I mentioned that in passing in the book is that just a couple of years ago, the philosopher here at NYU, Thomas Nagel, wrote a book in which he tried to question whether contemporary evolutionary biology has the resources to give an adequate account not only of human experience but human rationality and other features of human cultural and indeed human nature. And what was interesting is how times have changed. Now, at a time when it's much more commonplace to bring science and culture into dialogue with each other, he was very aggressively criticized, again, by people on the left who viewed the thought that he was calling attention to what may be limits to scientific explanation, potentially opens up the door to the religious right or to an anti-science, which is not Nagel's was not Nagel's ambition.
The book is published by Hill and Wang, and we'll continue our conversation after this. We're back with Alvin Noe, N-O-E. His book, Strange Tools, Art and Human Nature, is published by Hill and Wang. How would you define art? Do you have a standard definition?
Well, it's not exactly an orthodox one. I think of art as a practice for unveiling us to ourselves. Artists make things, not because the things they make are so special, but because making is profoundly definitive and special of what it is to be a human being.
Art has been defined differently over the ages, as I kind of suggested earlier. Do you think that any definition of art is a reflection of how we understand the world at any given time?
Well, that's not what I would say. I mean, I'm really trying to... It's a little bit like saying logicians over time have made discoveries about logic, but I think logic has, you know, runs through all time. And my project in this book is really to try to get at what art is and think about the way what it's always been.
Neuroscientists have many theories about why we make art. What are the current theories?
Well, actually, I think the striking thing about the neuroscience of art is that they don't really have many theories of it. They look at the different way in which the inspection of works of art depends on or is constrained by neural systems and neural structures.
So they watch our MRIs while we're looking at art that we like or don't like?
Something like that. And they try to figure out whether there are neural systems that I'm actually in a debate tonight at NYU on whether we can use neuroscience to help understand art. And I'm sort of pretty skeptical, mostly because I think that aesthetic experiences aren't stable things. How you respond to a work of art isn't sort of a given data point. It evolves through conversation and through thought and through interaction with other people over time.
I had an art teacher who would send us to the Whitney Biennials and to write down the works that we most liked and the ones we disliked the most. And it turned out that the same work showed up on both kinds of lists. And he said those are the important works because they actually elicited a strong response. The others, which we might have thought were perfectly nice, really were the ones that were going to be forgotten very soon.
For me, the interesting question is not do you like it or don't you like it, but why? And so that first response, I like it or I don't like it, I put it on my list or I don't, is really the beginning of a conversation or a thought process or a dynamic. And that, to me, is where the aesthetic experience really, really comes out and really enriches.
If neuroscience can't tell us about art, does the evolutionary approach have any more to tell us about why we make art?
Well, again, one of the problems is I'm more optimistic for an evolutionary approach. But one of the things that's, I wouldn't say it's a problem, but part of the challenge that art presents us is art isn't really something, in my view, it isn't really a phenomenon that we should be trying to explain. Art is actually itself a kind of a field of inquiry, a field of research, and it's not one thing. It's not thought, it's not emotion, it's not intellect. We use our entire intellectual and emotional and cognitive capacities to engage and also to make art.
Didn't Plato argue that artists are dangerous and blame them for misinforming the public?
That's one of the great paradoxes, because, of course, if you look at Plato's writing, he was nothing if not a great artist. I think he had a view about he had a suspicion of art, and for the same reasons that we you know try to protect our children from being exposed to adult movies or themes of or images of violence. Because he feared that you don't need knowledge of the subject matter of movies or films or pictures in order to make pictures that will fool people, so that pictures and works of art end up essentially pandering to our lower nature.
And he claimed that in a perfect world we wouldn't need medicine or art. I had an art teacher once who told me that his goal as a painter was to make works that people would touch and be healed by.
That's beautiful. No, but what Plato was really concerned with, I think, was less really art. He called it art and did think that the artist should be banned. But his real concern was with essentially a kind of art that was the moral equivalent of pornography.
Now, why do you call art strange tool in this book? How is it a tool? All tools strange in some ways, out of context.
Actually, the interesting thing about tools is they presuppose a function, and they are only useful in a context. So if you think of the door handle as a tool, door handles make sense in a society with people with bodies like ours that live in buildings like we do and that need to get from one room to another and have reasons for having doors. If you take a door handle and remove it from that background context in which it is what it is, namely a door handle, you've made something strange. And in doing that, in making something strange, you've actually prevented it from being the tool that it is. You've undermined its function. But you can do that in such a way as to make that very act illuminating, because now all of that which was taken for granted, all of that which was just hidden in the background, can be brought forward. And so my claim is that works of art are strange tools, but what I actually mean by that is they're not really tools anymore, because they're tools which ask you to reflect on what their function might be.
You're describing art as being able to transform us, but also be incredibly boring. Why is art boring, and is that a positive?
I don't think that art is always boring or that all art is always boring, But it's very important to notice that sometimes art provokes negative feelings and negative reactions in an audience. And for me, it was an important discovery that when I was a kid, I remember boring days in the summertime when there was nothing to do and you just sort of time seemed to reduce to a tick, 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 tick metronome. And one of the striking things is that we don't have that as grown-ups. And one of the reasons we don't have that as grown-ups, or very rarely, is because we're involved with projects and arcs of activity with beginnings and middles and ends. And, you know, my interview with you today, my visit to New York, my career as a philosophy professor, these stretches of time that are very organized. And one of the things that art often makes us do is stop, is interrupt ourselves, is step out of the arc. And that has the consequence, sometimes, of throwing us back on nothing but time. Tick, 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 a kind of metronomic encounter with time. And that can be very uncomfortable. And one of the things but I think it also should be realized that it's in some ways, it's a gift, it's a present, it's an opportunity that art affords us.
But it's also something that we relate to at different times in different ways. I've had this experience more than once where I didn't really like an artist all that much or didn't like some work. And then one day I was stopped by a work and said, oh my God, what have I... Giorgio Morandi, he's great.
Mm-hmm.
Or
what have
Rubens, why have I disliked him all these years? I can go on. There's so many.
Absolutely.
And it's because at that point in my life, I could see something that I couldn't see at any other time?
Or it's that you... It's not that you... It's... I mean, the remarkable thing is that Morandi didn't change. Rubens didn't change. But you asked the right question or you had the right key that let you... I wouldn't say see something that you hadn't seen before, but I'd say let you understand what you've been seeing. And so it can change. And what's really important is it can actually not only change your experience here and now, it can make you or enable you to revise all your past experience mm-hmm. of Rubens. So it's interesting to ask, where did the aesthetic experience stop? Did it stop when you left the church in Italy, or did it stop when your friend said, hey, did you ever notice this, which caused the transformation to happen?
Although I don't think I'll ever change my opinion about Renoir. I'll never like him. Alva Noe will be at NYU's Casa Italiana tonight at 5:30. That's at 24 West 12th Street. And then tomorrow at 9 o'clock at the Overthrow Boxing Club at 9 Bleecker Street. And he'll be talking with choreographer Mariah Evans and Jeffrey Gibson. His book, Strange Tools, Art and Human Nature, is published by Hill and Wang. And I thank you so much for being on our show.
A great pleasure. Thank you very much.